Good afternoon.
It's over at Ledge Legal. Yeah, I've talked to Mike, but it wasn't on the section.
Good afternoon. The House Judiciary Committee has convened in attendance. Our Representative Lynn, Representative Coghill, myself, Representative Ramirez, Vice Chair Dahlstrom, Representative Holmes, we anticipate being joined shortly by Grunberg and Samuels. I'll note for the record when they come in. Let me go over our program for today and for the remainder of the week. We think, although there has not been a flurry of public testimony that has followed this bill, there has been a great deal of public interest that has followed this bill, and I think we may have.
It's very interesting, Mr. Chair. I think we only had maybe one person, maybe two, in State Affairs Committee public testimony. Yes. I was very surprised.
Yes, thank you, Representative Lynn. But so that the process remains open, we've determined that we will begin each session today, tomorrow, Thursday, and Friday with public testimony and leave that open for the first 30 minutes unless there's nobody in the room or nobody online who wants to testify. And then we will hold it off to the next day. That way the public is welcome to weigh in. Anybody who's watching gavel to gavel, anybody who's listening at LIO are welcome to participate this way. And today we're going to, I've invited Representative Newman to discuss the implementation of the Newman rules, which again, not said in any disparaging sense, but rather really to highlight some of the considerable concerns that you brought to us and to Representative Grunberg. And then after a public testimony today, then we are going to take up titles 15 and 24 today and try and address amendments that coincide with those portions of the bill. Title 39 tomorrow, and then come back and pick up other concerns and other amendments as they emerge in the form of miscellany, still with the expectation that we can move this bill by the end of judiciary session on Friday. So with that, Mark, but Representative Newman, before you join us, let me ask if there's anybody online that wants to join us or anybody here in the room who would care to testify? Nobody online?
Yes, hi. This is Heidi Dragas. I'm in Anchorage at the LIO.
Oh, yes, I have you right here. I'm sorry, Heidi. I have that in front of me. How are you today?
Good. How are you?
Good. And who are you with, please?
I'm with Public Employees Local 71.
Okay. Please, we're going to try and limit testimony to 3 minutes, but we'll approach that liberally today. If you go ahead, please.
Okay, thanks. I'll do the best I can.
Sure.
I just want to discuss briefly an issue that's infecting many state employees, many Local 71 employees. Alaska has a long-standing nepotism statute, which is AS 3990020, and some regulations which prohibit family members from working together in a supervisory relationship. But in August of 2005, the Department of Administration promulgated a new policy, which is in the Alaska Administrative Manual, AAM 100050. And this policy prohibits employees from being in an employment relationship, quote, employment relationship with an immediate family member, including conjugal relationships up to the second degree of kindred. And this provision was enacted in response to a Department of Law memorandum that was issued in March 2005 on how the Executive Branch Ethics Act applies when a supervisor and a subordinate are in a conjugal relationship. The AG's opinion was that the relationship violated the Ethics Act. But the AG's opinion was just that the Ethics Act would prevent a supervisor and another employee from working together if they were family members or living in a conjugal relationship. The Department of Law, in promulgating the Alaska Administrative Manual 100050, has taken that opinion by the AG and dramatically expanded its scope. In defining a, quote, employment relationship, the department expanded it to include a vast number of actions typically completed by non-supervisory employees. And as it stands, the department's new policy, based on its interpretation of the Ethics Act and the March 2005 AG memorandum, has had devastating effects on Alaska's public employees, especially those living and working in rural and Native communities. The policy prohibits one family member from being hired, promoted, or transferred if it results in an employment relationship with another family member. This is true even if neither one of them is a supervisor, based solely on the minutest possibility that one of these family members may be promoted to a lead or foreman position, even if only for a day, when you know, for instance, that lead may want to take vacation. As most of you know, in Alaska, many of our communities are so small that most individuals are related in some way. The impact on non-supervisory employees is substantial and really is unnecessary. It's essentially prohibiting both supervisory and non-supervisory relationships between family members. The Department of Administration's policy is affecting everyday working Alaskans in such a way that was never intended nor implicated by the Ethics Act until last year. Family members who seek to work together in a non-supervisory employment relationship are held to an even stricter standard than legislative branch employees. Under longstanding state regulations enacted by the Alaska Labor Relations Agency, a supervisory employee is essentially defined as an individual who has the authority to act on behalf of a public employer in carrying out supervisory functions if the exercise of that authority is not routine but requires the exercise of independent judgment. And these functions are defined as the ability to take actions in the area of employment, which is hiring, transfers, layoffs, and recall, discipline, suspension, discharges, and the like, and grievance adjudication. But the department's new nepotism policy prohibits far more than just supervisory relationship. This realignment of policy using the state's nepotism statute and, more importantly, the Ethics Act to justify moving from a prohibition of supervisory relationships to now nearly all employment relationships has and will continue to prevent many Alaskans from seeking gainful employment from the state. The union suggests an amendment to the Ethics Act to add a Section D to 3952.910, which would create a bright line to clearly define that the Ethics Act issues arise in supervisory relationships between family members and not in all employee relationships. I'm not sure if you guys have the copy of the proposed amendment. I'm happy to read it to you now if you'd like.
Heidi, did you submit that?
I believe it has been submitted. I know it was submitted to the State Affairs Committee. I'm not sure if it has been submitted to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, my understanding is it's being drafted as we speak. How long is it, Heidi?
It's not long at all. Why don't I just, I'll go through it very quickly. What it says is that nothing in this act shall supersede the provisions of AS 3990-020, which is the nepotism statute, the longstanding nepotism statute, nor preclude individuals from being in an employment relationship with an immediate family member where neither family member is a supervisor who has the authority to act or effectively recommend action in the interest of the public employer in one of the following supervisory functions if the exercise of that authority is not merely routine but requires the exercise of independent judgment. And then after that lists those categories of supervisory functions that have, you know, that have been in existence in the state regulations for years and years and years, basically actions in the area of employment, discipline, and grievance adjudication. And I think, you know, the union believes that this amendment would clarify the scope of the Ethics Act and protect working Alaskans, especially those working in small rural and Native communities, yet also would strike a balance with by highlighting the ethical issues that are involved in familial supervisory relationships. And I think that this amendment will do that.
Heidi, thank you for your testimony. We look forward to seeing that drafted potential amendment tomorrow. I'm sure Pledge Legal is extremely busy and working overtime, and we appreciate them very, very much. Appreciate your testimony today, and I don't have on record anyone else registered to give public testimony. Is there anyone else online? And do I have anyone in the audience that would like to give public testimony at this moment? All righty, for today, we'll stop public testimony, but as Chairman Ramirez has stated, we will be having public testimony again tomorrow. So at this point, we'd like to invite Representative Newman to the desk, and if you would just state your name and affiliation for us and go over your concerns, we would appreciate it. Welcome.
My name is Mark. I'm one of you.
Thank you, Representative Bellstrom and Chair Ramirez. A question that I had posed to the State Affairs Committee is somewhat followed over through to the Judiciary Committee. And it came about when we were filling out the paperwork for the reporting requirements for a state legislator. And the problem arose where, as a small business owner, I had a question as to, and I think it probably was summarized very rightfully so by Representative Johnson, you know, what's fair and what's right. And
Representative Newman, if I could just interrupt you for a second. First of all, I want to recognize that Representative Gruenberg and Samuels have joined us. Representative Coghill is going to have to go in a minute. He's got to build up on with the other side. And Brooke, would you come up here with Representative Newman so that we can get your feedback while we have Representative Newman explaining this? If you'd pull the microphone forward just a little bit so that we can hear a little bit better, appreciate it. And with that, the floor is yours, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Ramirez. The question arose as a small business owner. I design and build custom fine furniture, and most of the stuff that I do is over $1,000. I will lose customers if I require them, and I feel rightfully so, I should inform them that I'm required to post their name, their address, what I built, and how much it was, how much it cost. And I rightfully feel that I think I will lose customers because of that. I think people will say, well, I would just as soon not have my name in public documents like that, and so I'll go somewhere else and get my furniture built. What it also does, too, is it opens up the book for my competition to know exactly what I'm charging for prices and give me a price range, somewhat of an unfair advantage. And in the spirit of having a citizens-based legislature, is it fair that I lose, and I will lose, business because I'm a legislator and I have to report that? And how do we deal with that problem? When I asked other legislators, when I brought it, first Representative Ramirez and Representative Gruenberg were present, Representative Gruenberg thought that probably those were goods that I were providing. So I've been told that I'm providing goods and not services, and so it would not be reportable because we were supposed to report services. I've asked other legislators about this who are familiar with it, and said, well, maybe your business should have to report, but you as a person doesn't have to report it. So if somebody wrote a check, they should have to write it to my business instead of me personally, which they do anyhow. Of course, that would go to my business. But this is kind of the dilemma that I've found myself in, and as being a citizen legislator. Is it fair to be forced to lose business because of the reporting? And I think that I will. So that's where I'm at, and that's the question that was posed.
Thank you. Let me just hear from Brooke first, and then Representative Gruenberg. Sure. Brooke, is that an accurate interpretation of the rules?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would say yes, that is an accurate representation of what is required under the law. There's no the defining point isn't whether it was goods or services, but how the business is conducted. It's my understanding that Representative Newman does not create furniture and put it in a store and customers come in and buy that furniture. He works individually and independently with clients, creating probably beautiful custom pieces of furniture, which is really not that different from what an attorney does with her clients. It's true that when Representative Newman is finished, the person has a beautiful piece of furniture, and when the attorney is finished, there's a stack of paper.
Bill,
but it's the way the business is conducted that determines how a financial disclosure statement must be completed.
Very good. Let me just recognize that our friend Representative Gardner is in the room. And do you wish to testify, Representative Gardner, or are you here to listen today?
Listen and listen.
spirit moves me.
Chair Rammers, if I may add.
Yes, and then Representative Gruenberg would like to pose a question.
Thank you, Chair Rammers. I do understand that if I was going to be building a piece of furniture for a lobbyist or anybody, another legislator, anybody that had any connections at all with the government, that would be reportable, or even if I thought that they would, because that would be right. But we're talking just the average customer off the street who has absolutely no business with the state besides probably voting.
Representative Gruenberg?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have been in error when I was thinking, you know, the difference between goods and services, because yours is a situation that obviously is probably closer to services. But let me just ask Ms. Miles, suppose Representative Newman, instead of doing customized furniture, had a furniture store and sold $1,000 worth of furniture to an individual. So it really was a sale of goods. Would that then not have to be reportable, whereas if he custom makes them, it does? And if so, what's the difference?
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Gruenberg, the difference is between a retail business and client services working in that relationship. For example, if a legislator owns a hotel and a restaurant, he is not required to list every single client who comes to that hotel or eats at the restaurant. However, if he has a contract, for example, with an entity to provide rooms over a block service, and that contract is worth more than $1,000, it's reported separately.
So,
if I may continue.
But let me just interject on that point of retail versus non-retail, because I am in that situation.
Yeah.
And so I do not report retail sales at the restaurant operation, nor would I report regular guests that are staying with us. But if I sell a block of rooms to Cruise West, Royal Celebrity, or gift shop sales, I don't report those either. But if I sell a block of rooms to Royal Caribbean, Cruise West, to Princess, I actually have to release to APOC, which becomes a public record. I sent a page or page and a half disclosing all of my primary relationships that are, it was what I had, that's the rules, the existing rules, not even the new ethics rules. Representative Gruenberg and then Samuels.
On that point, with the price?
Yeah, thanks.
That you charge?
The contracted price.
No. Contracted price?
No.
The contract, the current law requires disclosure of the amount if the source of the amount has a substantial interest in state political, administrative, or political activities.
But I would qualify that by saying that we do produce the dollar volume of the account. We don't produce the unique value of a per room contract, because it's
I have to.
We can fix that.
I have to list the client A paid me $10,012 for the divorce. That's right. In there. It happens that most furniture be under $1,000, not custom, but general furniture.
Not mine.
Nor mine.
Okay. but if you sold, if you were Ralph Seekins and sold cars, then he would have to list every car he sold. Is that correct?
On a fleet transaction.
On a fleet transaction, yes, not independently.
But, if he sold one car, even though it was more than $1,000, he doesn't have to list that?
That's correct. It's a retail business.
What is the policy behind, let's say he makes $1,000 profit on a car, and a person who makes $1,000 as a lawyer, although there's part of its profit, part of its overhead, but I find it difficult on a policy basis to make a distinction on it. I think that's a distinction without a difference, as we say. Through the chair.
There has historically been a difference between retail clients and non-retail clients since 1974, when the citizens first voted for this law. It has always been held that you don't have to disclose each individual who buys from a retail business is the source. However, each individual who buys the services of an attorney or of an accountant or, in this case, of a custom furniture builder would be the source.
Through the chair. I find it difficult to justify why a person who's a customer of a person who provides services has to be revealed, but a customer of a person who provides the same amount of goods, the same profit of goods, doesn't. And if that person doesn't, I don't know why the other person should have to be revealed. I don't see any policy difference between that.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Chair. If I may comment on some of the statements made. First off, all of my business is retail. I don't sell wholesale to anybody so that they can resell it again. If I was maybe selling a piece of marketing, a piece of furniture through Sadler's or a furniture company, then that would be wholesale. But my products are all resale, are retail. It's directly from me to a customer. And I don't see a difference. And again, you said that if you sell a block of rooms to Royal Caribbean, you have to report that. But if somebody stayed at your motel for a week, 10 days, and their bill was over $1,000, would you have to report that person?
No.
And that's what I'm saying is I think I fall into that category is providing a good like that.
Brooke?
Well, I understand your concerns. I understand this is a big policy statement. I can only tell you what the law currently requires. And the law currently would require that a person who conducts business in the manner you do would report his clients who paid more than $1,000 for
furniture. This sounds like so many phone calls, like deja vu, so many phone calls I've had to your office, with all due respect. But the rules are the rules. Representative Dahlstrom, and then I'm mindful of the clock a little bit so we can get on with today's events. And we can always pick this subject matter back up again tomorrow after we've had 24 hours to ruminate on it. Mm-hmm. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Brooke, thanks for the job that you and your department do. And you are just, you're here doing your job. You didn't create these rules. You are the one that, you and your team that follows through. We understand the difference and appreciate that at some times during this you may feel a little bit awkward, but none of this is aimed at you. So just to clarify that. Two issues. I personally fall into somewhat of the same category that Representative Newman falls under, in that my husband is we own a business, and he's a contractor. And he gains his jobs by bid. So if we needed to list everything out and his competitors were to, to look and see, and if he consistently wins a bid by $100, mm-hmm. or consistently loses by a certain amount, the reality of the matter is that depending on the size of the construction company and the type of business, many of them operate in somewhat as the same ways as some portions of our state government operate, mm-hmm. and that is that some bids are always pretty straightforward and they come within a couple $100s, and other companies will put out a bid with the opportunity that they can come back later with a $500,000 or $1 million supplemental and know full well that they will get their paycheck, mm-hmm. and so they are consistently going to be able to get a bid. So, personally, I agree with that. We have some issues we need to work out. But a question for you also on pertaining to the legal profession. What happens when a lawyer is not a state attorney general or a prosecutor or anything paid by the muni or the state, but they represent a child in need or a minor child? Some of the most horrendous cases we have often in the paper, they're referred to as minor A or minor B or whatever, and someone is paying those expenses. How do we not violate some sort of constitutional rules listing who is paying that case? And if there's a protection matter there, are we not putting that person, that child, at risk, or even potentially men or women who have been victims of abuse?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dahlstrom, with respect to attorneys, it's a little easier for me to answer because Anytime a case is sealed by the court or it affects minor children, there are certain cases that are never required to be made public. The name of the client is not required to be made public because it would violate other rulings and other laws. For medical doctors, psychiatrists, counselors, and a number of others that are subject to the HIPAA law, they cannot disclose their client's name. And that law, of course, trumps APOC's law. Mm-hmm. And then if I may, Mr. Chairman, this is huge policy decisions that are before you today, and it's one of the hardest things you can ever do. And that's the balancing of the public's right to know.
Right.
And the individual's right to privacy and or an individual's ability to keep trade secrets and conduct a successful business. Really hard.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you. I'm still getting around your block rooms having to disclose them, so I have a question. Current policy in the bill does not change the fact that if I owned a very small portion of my employer, this little airline, $5,000 of value, which no say in the corporate world of how that worked, I would have to disclose every block ticket that airline sold. Every time we sold 100 tickets to a school district, a native corporation, a convention, a fish company, an oil company, a timber company, the government, I would have to disclose all of those as if I had influence on those and tell you the aggregate amount of money per block ticket that I've sold? Is that what I thought you'd say about your rooms?
I think so.
Mr. Chairman, if I can, now this brings in some new applications, and that would be how the business is constructed. If it is an Inc., an INC, and you do not own a controlling interest, you're not required to disclose the clients of that company. If it is a PC, which many attorneys have, or an LLC, which is actually a partnership, or a partnership, or a sole proprietorship, then you're in the position of reporting the client names.
So corporations know, unless you own 51%.
Unless you have a controlling interest, correct.
I'd like to inject two remarks, if I can. One is, we have Ocean Rangers coming before this committee next Wednesday. The Ocean Rangers deals with the cruise ship head tax. The cruise ship head tax has, in my perception, detrimental effects on Royal Celebrity, Princess, and Cruise West. I think it's appropriate for the public to know that I have a relationship with those entities. If I'm going to weigh in as a citizen legislator, then to a certain degree, I have to surrender some of my privacy for the privilege of being a citizen legislator so that I can be forthright in the relationships that I have that may hold sway for better and for worse, is my first comment. The second comment that I'm struck by, Brooke, is when I was, goofing around here a second ago, and I said it's deja vu, it sounds like a phone call to APOC, and you guys are wonderful on the phone, but I mean, the rule's the rule. I hang up the phone, and I'm like, I'm sure Representative Salmon is like you. Sometimes I look at the phone, not you, because you do an impeccable job. I don't think anybody in this committee or this building would agree more with what Representative Dahlstrom said, impeccable. And the same thing with Joyce at Ethics, it's impeccable, but it still leads many of us to stare at the phone after the call and wonder, okay, well, what do I do next? And I think that that's the point of view that Representative Newman brings to us today. And so the question I would have is if the opportunity to open the ethics book or to open the APOC book comes along so rarely, and because of the unique situation that the public integrity section of the FBI brought to us earlier this year, we now have an opportunity to open this big book of ethics and disclosure. And I think that my question for you, Brooke, is what can we do to create a Newman rule so that in this case you have the opportunity to say it's not just what's in the book, that this is a policy call. We are opening up the policy book. We can make changes. I'm comfortable with the restrictions that APOC has placed on me. I don't like them, but I'm comfortable and I understand the balancing act that they accomplish. I get it. I'm not looking for any special dispensation in that regard. But I am troubled by the lack of Newman rules.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'd like to do is to wind this up today and to charge each of you as the Newman. and Brooke as the executive director APOC to come back to us tomorrow in the first half hour of this session and say, okay, here's what we think, here's what our best idea is to address this need, because we need people like you, Republican or Democrat, serving in this building in these two bodies. We need people like every one of us. There's a whole collection of characters at this table, and I use that term loosely. and I don't exclude Representative Gardner from the description. but we need people like Newman in the legislature, and we can't do things that discourage his service, nor things. It's tough enough to maintain a small private sector business the other 240 days of the year. We cannot make it more difficult for somebody like Newman or for Kit Dahlstrom or for Ralph Samuels or for an attorney Lindsay Holmes and Representative Gruenberg and
realtor
and a realtor like Representative Rokeberg or Lynn or myself or Representative Coghill at all. So if we could come back tomorrow, and Mark, you sent me a note that it should pertain to sales with substantial political influence. It's interesting. Brooke, I don't know what kind of thoughts you might have on the matter, but if we could pick this up tomorrow at 1 o'clock at Representative Gruenberg.
I have a question for Mr. Jones.
Yes.
It has nothing to do with this.
Okay, then let's wind up this segment. Does that seem like something that we can work on over
sure.
this 24-hour cycle? And whether the two of you want to work on it together, which I would encourage, or to Representative Newman, does this seem like a...
Yeah, Chair Amherst, yes, it does. But I think when Ms. Miles was first stated of what she said the rules were, they dealt with sales to citizens or companies with political finance or substantial political influence. And I think just the average Joe off the street does not meet that requirement, whether it's you selling it to a room to somebody or whatever. I don't think that it meets that requirement. We'll look at it.
Well, I will take this slip of paper, Representative Newman. We'll tape it right here on the desk, and tomorrow we will contend with that along with the best idea that you and Director Miles can come up with. So we thank you both.
Thank you, Chair Amherst, and community.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Homework assignment.
Yes, we'll see you tomorrow. And Mr. Jones, if you would join us. Representative Gardner left the room, so we're going to let me just, for housekeeping, is there anybody else in the room that wants to testify on ethics? Is there anybody else online? Okay. Seeing none, public testimony for today is closed, and we will take up public testimony tomorrow at 1 p.m. And for anybody watching gavel to gavel, we will take up public testimony again on Thursday at 1 o'clock, Friday at 1 o'clock, 1-ish, 1:05, 1:07. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. I assume we're going to adjourn pretty quickly here.
We're going to what?
Are we about to adjourn here? I wanted to ask. Oh, okay, not.
We're going to proceed to amendments and Titles 15 and Title 24. I'm sorry. Okay. You were out of the room. We're going to do Title 15 and 24 today, Title 39 tomorrow. We're going to maintain public testimony the first 30 minutes, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And then on Thursday and Friday, we will pick up with miscellany as it relates to any three of the large, Title 15, 24, or 39, with the intent and the expectation of passing this bill out Friday at the close of business.
I had, if I may ask Mr. Johnson questions. In the State Affairs Committee, we were dealing with a constitutional amendment for an elected attorney general. And we talked a bit about whether there should be some ethical rules dealing with potential conflicts in the position of Attorney General as an appointed Attorney General. I don't know that you were part of that hearing at the time, but at the federal level today, we're seeing some problems with the U.S. Attorney General, potentially ethical problems that are presented as a result of allegations of firing certain U.S. attorneys for refusal to do political kinds of things. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on whether there should be some provisions in either Title 39, the Executive Ethics Act, or in Title 44, the section dealing with the Attorney General Department of Law, specifically for ethical rules for the Attorney General for these unique conflicts of interest kinds of situations. And if you don't have an answer for me now, I'd like you to think about that, and we can talk about it. Do you have any thoughts, or do you want to think about that? Through the chair.
First, for the record, my name is Dave Jones. I'm an assistant attorney general with the State of Alaska Department of Law. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, it is not something that I've given thought to. I would appreciate the opportunity to give it more thought. My initial reaction is that between the rules of professional conduct and the existing requirements of the Executive Branch Ethics Act, we should have those concerns covered. But again, I think I'd appreciate the opportunity to give it some more thought.
Yes, through the chair. I'd like you to do that and possibly talk to other people in your department about that, because we did discuss that, and I have the chair of the State Affairs Committee here, and we did bring that up in the committee, and it's particularly timely now dealing with what's going on with Washington. But I'm talking specifically about potential conflicts, some dealing with the Attorney General himself or herself, and some with that type of authority within that department. And if we could just talk on that, or you get something back to me. I don't know if